Philadelphia, Mississippi, 1964. This small traditional southern town is the center of an invasion. Racism throughout the American South will soon be challenged, but not without one last fight. In the course of this struggle, three civil rights activists will disappear, drawing worldwide attention to this peaceful people with a burning secret. In the early 1960s, the people of Mississippi are no different from people anywhere else. They are proud of their city and town. They believe strongly in their worth and are eager for change. But a new wind is about to blow across Mississippi, and it is coming from the north. In the summer of 1964, 1,000 college students from across the northern United States are preparing to travel to Mississippi to encourage black people to vote. In July, President Johnson is about to sign a new civil rights bill into law. In a sense, this is the beginning of the end of black oppression. But generations of hatred could not be eliminated by a single law. The student movement was organized by CSEFO, the Council of Federal Organizations, Amor Relations. This group brought together a host of organizations dedicated to defending black civil rights. The mission was called the Summer Project. Joe Sullivan, then an FBI agent, tells us, very quickly, the locals perceived this event as the summer invasion of the Mississippi. They were quite upset. That was the beginning of the problem. The closer the arrival of the students approached, the more the local population became resistant. During the day, life went on as usual, although people whispered among themselves about the bad times ahead. But at night, their words turned into actions. That was the time that the Kukau, Clan the Invisible Empire, chose to create a stir. It would not remain invisible for very long. Civil rights activists who trained in the Ohio knew they would be unwelcome, but they had no idea of the true implications of their actions. For the members of SOFO, Mississippi, with its long history of segregation and bigoted racism, was the hardest target they could hit. But it would also be their greatest victory. Bob Moses was one of the organizers of the Summer Project. In the minds of all blacks, Mississippi is the epitome of racism. As we organized the campaign, one question haunted us. We could pass the new civil rights bill if we wanted to. We could change things, but unless there was real change in Mississippi, we could not rid ourselves of the infection of racism because Mississippi was its home. 6 months before the students arrived, Michael Schwerner, 24, moved from New York to Meridian, Mississippi to set up a base of operations. Schwerner met with the pastor of the Monzion Methodist Church in Longwood to ask if he would lend them the church for CO4 meetings. The black population of Longwood had coexisted peacefully with their white neighbors. Now they were in the middle of a delicate situation. The church council had to weigh the pros and cons of advancing civil rights or possible retaliation for the black population. The council ended its meeting without reaching an agreement. But the Cook Clan would make a decision for them. Many church members, including women, were savagely beaten. Later that evening, the Manson church was set on fire. The local police did not investigate, but the FBI looked into the matter. FBI agents wanted to make sure there had been no federal violations.
Yes.
He knew that once the students arrived, the summer would be long and hot. The case was called the Mississippi Burning. The agents conducted their own investigation, asking church members what they had seen the night of the fire. The Ku Klux Klan members were wearing masks, but witnesses recalled seeing a man in a pickup truck wearing a sheriff's hat. A law enforcement officer was likely involved. This was not surprising. Many people in the South resented the federal government's push for forced integration. Local authorities often sought to keep things as they were. The general trend was to distrust the federal government. The population opposed any attempts at change. They saw us as the enemy. Blacks were no longer their only enemies. The federal government was just as much. Jim Ingram, who is now a member of the Mississippi Public Safety Commission, was an FBI agent in Jackson in the 1960s. It was a thankless job during that time.
We would travel all over the state. We could be in Natchez or Philadelphia, or we would be in Hinsburg investigating crimes committed against Mississippians. We were always away from home, and we would receive threats. We would find snakes in our mailboxes, for example. We always had to lock our car doors. We never knew what we would find when we got in. We were also threatened with harm to ourselves and our families.
Despite all these attempts at intimidation, the number of FBI agents in the state would soon increase 100-fold. Michael Schwerner was working on setting up the COFO Operations Center in Meridian, Mississippi, with his wife Rita. James Cheney, a 20-year-old PLA, joined them. Chen had been born in Meridian. He knew the way of life and the political climate of the area. Michael Schwerner, 24, was a liberal-leaning young man from the Bronx. He had earned a bachelor's degree in social sciences from a top university. His background was very different from Cheney's, yet the two young men shared the same goals. Schwerner's friends called him Mickey, a nickname he was not used to hearing outside the office.
The townspeople, and I am referring to the members of the clan in particular, called him the Boo, because he had a goatee. He said he was the devil.
Soon, Andrew Goodman, 20, joined Schwerner and Cheney. This volunteer was from Queens, New York, and he had finished his training in Ohio only a week earlier. Lute Schwerner returned to New York while the three men and other volunteers prepared to receive the first group of 200 social workers from the North. The first wave of the invasion was scheduled to arrive on June 21st, 1964. That morning, Schwerner, Chen, and Goodman drove to Longwood, 35 miles from Meridian. There, he was to meet with members of the Monsignon Church to discuss the fire that had occurred 5 days earlier. Cheney, who knew the area, would drive. They were the vanguard of the peace march, so to speak, and they knew they were in danger. They followed strict instructions: stay on the highway, cooperate with authorities, and never travel at night. They planned to return home that afternoon. Schwerner instructed his employees to call the CFO office in Jackson if he did not hear from them by 4 p.m. He never called. CFO members notified the FBI when they noticed that Mickey Schwerner had not called the office as scheduled. The agents contacted local authorities to see if anyone had seen Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. There was a lead. According to Nobe's Sheriff Price, the trio were returning from Longwood when he asked them to pull over near Philadelphia, 40 miles from Meridian. He drove them to the Philadelphia County Jail. Jenny had been booked for speeding. The other two men were being held in connection with the Manzion church fire. Chen was locked up in a cell designated for black prisoners. Schwerner and Goodman shared a separate cell. They were not allowed to make phone calls until the end of the day, a few hours after 4 p.m., the time they had agreed to call Kofo. According to another person who shared their cells, when Jolier's wife told Schwerner he could make a call to Frau Viret, he declined her offer. No one ever followed up on why. Eventually, Schwerner posted Chen's $20 bail and Officer Price released the men. It was now 10:30 p.m. It was unclear what happened to them afterward. Officer Sullivan feared for the lives of the three activists in the Mississippi burning case. He suspected that they had not simply been released from jail, but had likely been turned over to members of the Ku Klux.
This was the kind of crime I was used to. They imprison a person and then turn him over rather than actually release him. I was used to this procedure, and I was pretty sure that was what had happened.
The starting point for the investigation was Deputy Sheriff Price, the last person to have seen Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. This last Santin had the same version. He had released them around 10:30 p.m., but could not account for his own whereabouts during the next hour. Joe Sullivan had been sent from Memphis to handle this investigation. That was the only lead, and it was a slim one.
The sheriff's office was complicit. I was convinced of it. But I had no proof. All I knew was that this wasn't the first time something like this had happened. I began to pay attention to the training I revealed, according to the person I was talking to.
FBI agents began searching for the three young men. No one had seen them, or so they said. Then, on June 23, days after they disappeared, their vehicle was found. Two Chukchi Indians from a nearby Indian reservation had seen their vehicle on fire the following evening. The car had been set on fire in a shanty town called Bogito, just 20 yards off the highway near Philadelphia. When they realized that this was no small incident, they called the FBI. Special Agent Jeroen from Washington was dispatched to the scene. This firearms and explosives expert had extensive experience in civil rights conflicts. When he saw the car, he knew he would have a hard time finding any clues. By examining the burned-out vehicle, we tried to find human remains. We also looked for any clues that would help us determine what had happened to these civil rights activists. The car was too badly damaged to provide any information. But nearby, something gave us hope. It was a watch and the keys to a car. It was determined that it was Schwerner's watch. It had stopped at 12:45 p.m. News of the discovery spread like wildfire.
The vehicle had barely been discovered when the news was already circulating on the police telex and the radio and so on and so forth. We found ourselves with a crowd of curious onlookers in Bojito, and that made things difficult for us.
The discovery did not rule out the possibility of a setup. But for the investigators, there was no way they would find these men alive. From the beginning, we knew we would not leave the scene until we found the bodies. Hoover would not tolerate it, nor would the public. We had to find these bodies, no matter how long it took. By summer, the student invasion began. The eyes of the world were on the Mississippi. In Mecca, Deputy Sheriff Price and his superior, Lawrence Rye, refused to speak to reporters. To them, the disappearance of three civil rights activists did not deserve all the attention. The search continued. Four 400 sailors from Naval Air Station Meridian were on duty. They took turns searching the woods and waterways. FBI agents learned that the body of a black man had been recovered from the Mississippi River near Vicksburg. They went to the scene to raise concerns. Vicksburg was 140 miles away, but it was possible that Cheney's body had been swept away by the current. That was their only lead. We then discovered that this was not the body of one of the civil rights activists, but rather the victim of a Ku Klux Klan mob. This would not be the only false lead that summer. Other lynching victims were found. Some of these disappearances had never been reported because in these areas, the Klan couple ruled the roost. The FBI's top priority was to find the three militants, although its ultimate goal was to dismantle the Ku Klan. As the students continued their work, the scorching Mississippi heat heated up their minds. The Ku Klan's activities intensified. Over the course of that summer, more than 60 black-owned churches, businesses, and homes were burned, and that was just the beginning.
I saw the violence, the killings. I saw people without shelter because of the fires. I saw churches burned in the middle of the night and lives lost for absolutely no reason. I saw all these crimes committed by a group of people who believed they were right.
In order to reduce the Ku Klan's hold on the South, President Johnson authorized the FBI to open a new office in Jackson, Mississippi, 3 weeks after the three militants disappeared. While some agents continued to search the swamp, others knocked on doors looking for leads. The people were polite but uncooperative. The FBI's strategy was to divide and conquer. Agents attended the Ku Klan rally, taking pictures and writing down license plate numbers until they were finally asked to leave. Fortunately, they had time to gather the information they wanted.
When we met some people again, they assured us that they were not part of the Klan. Yes, but why were you at one of their meetings if you were not one? Did you know that they had bombed a church? Did you know that they had destroyed a school or tried to end racial segregation? Is that how you see it? Most of them said no. Going to these meetings allowed us to discourage many of them. Some stopped going because they feared they would be visited later.
Others were harder to convince. Officers were assigned to each clan member to monitor them. If any violence occurred, the officer was responsible for contacting the clan member he was responsible for and questioning him about it.
They quickly expressed their displeasure at being woken up at 3 a.m. when a crime had been committed 4 counts away. After a while, their wives asked us to stop. Their children also wanted us to stop harassing them. That was when we were able to open up a dialogue, and they understood who we were. We called each other by our first names.
Soon some informants came forward. Some of them were wives, others guilt-ridden members of the Kokox clan. They provided bits of information without their neighbors knowing. To encourage these informants, civil rights and religious organizations provided funds to pay them. The veil of silence was finally beginning to lift. An informant suggested that the agents question a young man named Will Murphy Jones. He was 19 years old and lived in Chicago. He had left Philadelphia abruptly about 3 weeks before the men disappeared. He had not left of his own free will. He told the agents that his problems had begun on June 1. He had gone to a jewelry store to have his graduation ring enlarged. The woman who served him was somewhat hesitant, but she agreed to fix it anyway. Shortly thereafter, he was arrested by Sheriff Riney and Officer Price. They took him into custody, allegedly for asking the young woman out on a date. He was not allowed to make any phone calls. When he was finally released shortly after midnight, a gaggle of a man was waiting for him. They seized him and forced him into a van. His captors drove him to a secluded area. They then tried to force him to confess that he had made advances toward the young woman. Will Murphy Jones swore that he had done nothing. The men were ready to kill him on the spot. Then one of them, who called himself the pastor, decided to spare him. He told Jones to leave town forever or he would be a dead man. Jones boarded the first bus that left town. Will Murphy Jones' account seemed like a likely scenario for the disappearance of the three activists. But perhaps they had not been so lucky. They had been murdered.
We had other clues about what happened to individuals who were taken into custody in a jail, and then how they were disposed of. If it had happened once in Nicola County, it could have happened again.
The agents believed that Jones could help them find the bodies of the three civil rights workers. They asked him to take them to the place where the gang had beaten him. The search was on. In the meantime, Sullivan was gradually gaining the trust of a potential informant. This informant would only talk on condition of complete anonymity. His identity is not known to this day, since there may still be attempts on his life. He was nicknamed Mr. X. On July 31, 1964, Mr. X finally agreed to open up to the Sullivan Agency.
After exchanging a few pleasantries, I asked him if he could reveal anything significant. He told me that he thought he knew where the bodies were. I asked him to tell me where.
According to Mr. X, Goodman, Chen, and Schwerner had been buried under a dike at Old Jolly Farm. This farm belonged to Hollenberg, one of the wealthiest men in the county. The agents could not go there immediately. They knew that the clan couple were watching their every move. He did not want him to suspect that an informant had given them this lead. They finally obtained a warrant to search Old Jolly Farm. Slivan sent Agent Cran along with other agents. When they arrived at the site, they found that the search could not be carried out by simply digging. The dike was not yet finished. It was 165 meters long, 6 meters high, and 3 meters wide at its top. It was reasonable to assume that the bodies had not been simply buried, but rather that the dike had been erected directly over them. The agents wanted to keep their excavation work secret, but that would be difficult. They had to find a foreign contractor who had the machinery to move the earth. By August 4, the machinery was in place. The contractor was asked what would be the best way to remove the earth.
Cran asked him when the dike had been built, how it had been made, why it had been shaped the way it was, and how long it had taken to erect it.
He replied, "Well, you certainly know what you're looking for," to which I did not respond. At no point during our conversation did we clearly tell either the construction crew or the foreman what we were looking for. But they must have been idiots not to know what we were looking for.
The foreman then gave the agents a quick dig. Cran then stuck a stick in the ground to indicate where he wanted the excavation to begin. Then suddenly, in a gesture that has become legendary in FBI annals, he changed his mind.
Cran picked up his stick and, for some reason known only to his guardian angel, he moved 15 feet and replanted his stick, saying, "Dig here, Inns, instead." Where the bodies were.
The work, which had begun at 8:30 a.m., was progressing slowly. By 2:45 p.m., the grave was 13 feet deep. The acrid odor of death could already be smelled. The machinery was abandoned and garden tools were used. As the day wore on and the sun grew stronger, the odor became more powerful. Flies arrived by the hundreds as if to confirm the success of the search. Shortly after 3 p.m., the first body was found about 13 feet deep. It was identified by the contents of his wallet. It was Mickey Schwerner. Goodman was then dug up and chained up.
It is very difficult to describe. It is the very picture of man's inhumanity. Killing people for no good reason.
The bodies had been buried for over a month. It was therefore impossible to determine their cause of death at once. A dispatch was sent. He was accompanied by Deputy Sheriff Price alone.
They arrived on the scene as if it were part of the sheriff's routine business. "Did you find any bodies?" "Very interesting. They were pretty inactive."
Price and the coroner removed the bodies from the grave and sent them to the state hospital in Jackson for autopsies.
"See, Price took them away. I didn't help them do that." "I let the local authorities do their job. It was their jurisdiction." so we couldn't be accused of confusing the issue or tampering with evidence.
Was the presence of the deputy sheriff at the scene an example of the criminal's return to the scene? Well, he didn't give anything away. The eyes of every officer on the scene were glued to Price. I didn't notice any emotional reaction, and I don't think anyone else noticed anything either. The autopsies were performed on the bodies in Jackson. All three men had been shot. Schwerner and Goodman had been shot with a Chen 3 bullet. The right hand of Goodman, a hard substance that looked like rock. Regardless of what happened that night, it seemed that the bullet Goodman received did not put an end to his nightmare. We had the substance analyzed by the FBI lab. It was clay. Its composition was identical to that of the dam soil. This implied that Gunman was still alive at the time he was buried. The projectiles collected from the victims were then analyzed by the FBI Ballistics Unit. Most of the 5,000 weapons that make up the collection are weapons that were confiscated in crimes. The research equipment has changed a lot since 1964, but the role of the experts has remained the same, to prove that a given firearm was used to fire a given projectile. Today, test firing is the responsibility of Supervisor and Special Agent Paul Tandrin.
As the bullet passes through the barrel, it is subject to irregularities. These irregularities are unique to each firearm. The bullet is then marked by the barrel. It's a bit like the gun's fingerprint.
Projectiles from a crime are examined side by side with those obtained during test firings. If they were fired from the same firearm, experts will be able to see the same pattern repeating from one projectile to the next using a stereoscope. Conversely, if they were not fired from the same firearm, there will be no match.
There are many markings, but few of them are identical. These characteristics of two projectiles fired from two different firearms, but of the same model.
Using similar analyses, the FBI concluded that Cheney had received 38 caliber projectiles from two different firearms. Furthermore, the explosive powder residue indicated that the three men had been killed at close range. The approximate cost of the bullets that killed these men was 25 cents. Suddenly, to the people of Nisobakablede, the three civil rights activists were no longer part of a frame-up. It was a turning point in the investigation. Racists didn't accept that white men had been murdered. According to Agent Jim Ingram, the FBI was no longer seen as the enemy.
They realized that the killers were very violent. The situation changed in our favor. People wanted to help us, especially those in the small town of Philadelphia. It was amazing how many people said, "Look, if these killers are among us, we want to find them, arrest them, and convict them."
Sergeant Wellos Miller of the Meridian Police Department was a respected member of the Cook Clan who felt he had seen enough. He wanted to leave the clan, but the FBI convinced him to stay. Now, the agents had a mole. There was finally a breach in the walls of the Invisible Empire. Sergeant Miller proved that he was not involved in the murders of the three militants. He assisted the FBI by obtaining information from other members of the Ku Klux Klan. Other individuals like himself began to come forward as well.
No.
One knew that the other members were talking. The agents gathered information. From interviews with various informants, the FBI compiled a list of Klauger members involved. The same names kept coming up. The murders had been planned by Sam Bowers, the Grand Wizard of the White Knights of the Cook Club. His right-hand man was Edgar Killen. He was apparently the pastor who had spared Wilmer's life, F. Jones.
Informants were giving us first-hand information. Individuals who had been involved in the murders even agreed to sign confessions.
Confessions led to more confessions. Slowly, the events that had transpired began to unfold. The plan was deadly simple. While Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney were in custody, Deputy Sheriff Price had called Pastor Killen, who had then arrived with other members of the coven. They had filled up the car with gas, loaded their firearms, and waited for the three men to be released so they could carry out their Grand Wizard's plan. The militants were released at 10:30 p.m. The coven was waiting. Just outside Philadelphia, the militants noticed headlights approaching rapidly in their rearview mirrors. They accelerated to 100 miles per hour to escape them. One of the three vehicles misfired. Deputy Sheriff Price's car was one of the other two cars. He turned on his flashing light. Cheney pulled the car over to the side of the road. Price grabbed him and pulled him out of the car. Schwerner and Goodman were escorted to the back of the police car. As Cheney prepared to follow them, Price hit him with a truncheon and pushed him into the car. They drove back along Highway 19. One of the gang members was driving to the victim's car. The murders were committed without further ado. Schwerner was killed first. The cars had stopped on a side road. The car was felt he was turned over and shot at point-blank range. Gunman was killed in the same way. The gang members kept themselves chained for last. He was killed by two men. Their bodies were then put back in their vehicle. They were driven to Old Jolly Farm, where the bulldozer operator waited in the dark, ready to bury the bodies under 13 feet of clay. Then the victim's vehicle was driven into the marshes, poured gasoline on it, and set it on fire. On November 25, the FBI announced that it had learned the identities of those who had killed the three activists. In the United States, murder charges, however, are under state, not federal, jurisdiction. The FBI could only charge members with violating the civil rights of the three victims. It was unlikely that the state of Mississippi would pursue murder charges. More than 5 months later, 19 men were charged with treason, conspiracy to oppress and intimidate activists, and prevent them from exercising their constitutional rights. Two other men were charged with aiding and abetting because they knew the murders were going to happen. All posted bail and were released. A preliminary hearing was scheduled for December 10.
We realized the scope of the evidence we had collected, the photos of the dam, the bodies, the autopsy photos, the burned vehicle, and so on and so forth. We had an enormous amount of physical evidence, circumstantial evidence that corroborated the confessions we had obtained.
It was an impressive investigation,
and we were fortunate to have two outstanding prosecutors on our team. We believed it would be impossible to discredit our evidence, but we also knew that Mississippi was going through a tumultuous time and did not like what we had done.
The trial was in trouble from the start. At the preliminary hearing, the judge refused to allow written testimony. The government applied pressure, and on January 11, a grand jury found 18 men guilty, including Sheriff Renee and his deputy Price. Unfortunately, the charge was no longer a felony, but a misdemeanor. The case dragged on until 1966, when the United States Supreme Court finally ruled that there had been a felony. Three years after the murders, on October 9, 1967, a trial was held in federal court in Marion. For 10 days, the nation waited for the verdict. But there was none. The jury failed to reach a unanimous verdict.
Immediately, the people in Moran's courtroom began laughing, hugging each other, and saying that they had won since the jury had not reached a verdict. The judge then told them that this was not the case, that the jury should continue deliberating.
So the jury returned to deliberation. The next morning, October 20, 1967, they had finally reached a verdict. Of the 18 men charged, 8 men, including Grand Wizard Sam Bowers and Deputy Sheriff Sal Price, were found guilty of violating the civil rights of the three activists. 3 years had passed since the murders. Justice had finally been served, but the price of that justice was paltry. Bowers received the harshest sentence, only 10 years in prison. While only Price was sentenced to 6 years in prison, Sheriff Reine and the pastor were both acquitted. None of the accused men were prosecuted by the state. Most of them still live in Mississippi. And although there was talk of reopening the case, all evidence was destroyed by court order several years ago. The hatred that divided the nation did not disappear easily. According to activist Bob Moses, however, the events in Mississippi marked the beginning of a significant change.
What has changed in Mississippi is that before the 1960s, the state was set apart from the rest of the country. People did not hesitate to defy the law to maintain that apartheid. Now the law is respected as it is in the rest of the country. Mississippi has become a state like any other.
Donations helped rebuild the church in Manziana. It has become a place of pilgrimage in honor of the three men who came here hoping to make a difference and who succeeded, but in ways he had hardly anticipated. Mickey Schwerner and Andrew Goodman were in New York. As for James Chaney, his grave is in the hills outside Meridian. It is marked with graffiti left there by vandals.